through its doors, just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. A new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day.
And hello again, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today, my guest is Joanne Mapson. She is back again with yet another wonderful book, The Owl and Moon Cafe. She is author of 8 books of mainstream fiction, as well as many freelance articles, book reviews, and she's been included in several anthologies. One of her novels, Blue Rodeo, was made into a CBS television movie starring Kris Kristofferson and Anne Margaret. Hank and Chloe, The Wilder Sisters, and Bad Girl Creek were national bestsellers. Bad Girl Creek was a 2002 BookSense 76 pick, as well as an alternate selection for Doubleday, Literary Guild, and Book of the Month clubs. And as I said, she is back again with The Owl and the Moon Cafe, and I'm so happy to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
So your book was released on 4th of July.
It was supposed to be released on 4th of July, but it started getting seen in bookstores and sent from Amazon about a week and a half before that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely out now.
Now, when I was sent a book, it came with a piece of fudge. Now, is that how it will be sold in stores, or how do readers get this fudge?
How do I get the fudge? Actually, if they email me their address, I will send them a piece of fudge.
And give your email.
jamapson@aol.com.
This is so cute. It has a label that very much fits in with the book. Tell me about that.
Well, the fudge in the book kind of is a staple of the restaurant. And so I was trying to think of fun things to give away with the book. And Stuart and I were standing in line in a Blockbuster one night, and they had this big box of fudge. and the piece is the same one that you're holding.
Yes.
Looked pretty darn good to me. So I wrote down their name, and we tried to see if we could get some wholesale fudge, and they sent us a lot, and then we made the stickers and put them on ourselves. I sent some to New York, and I have some with me, and if you come see me at a book signing and buy a book, I will give you a piece of fudge.
This is very cool.
And if you want the fudge only at the book signing, it costs $14, and you get a free book with it.
Oh, this is great. So, the Owl on the Moon Cafe. The last books you wrote were a trilogy that, obviously, the trilogy was trilogy, three books, and on to a new sort of book, although you have, you mentioned some of the characters from the past books, the past couple of books in this one.
Mm-hmm.
And how did this one come about? Where did it come from?
Well, my publisher didn't like the book I had turned in, the book proposal I had turned in. And I was at home recovering from rotator cuff surgery, so I was, like, on lots of meds.
Mm-hmm.
And my agent called and said, they didn't like the book. Think of something else. Tell me right now. And I said, okay, The Owl and Moon Cafe, where it came from, I don't know, blame Vicodin. And then I said, it'll be about four, you know, generations of the same family, and that's it. And that was good enough for them. They were happy with that. So it came about in a Vicodin haze.
Now, it's interesting because, you know, you've had a lot of novels published, and the myth is that when you are well published, that you don't go through misery anymore.
Well, who told you that?
Well, they didn't tell me that, but I hear this all the time. You know, students think, if I just get one book out there, then the rest is just gravy, and it'll just be easy after that. And it's
well,
not.
Well, actually, no, and I'm so glad you brought that up, because it is true that, you know, the best writers, the most published writers, anybody, you know, it can have a tank at any time. You're only one way, one bad book away from not being ever heard from again. And times are really tight in publishing now. I'm sure you've talked about this on your show. You know, they're accepting fewer books and trying to only take books that they know will sell. So there's a tightening up there.
But just that they know will sell, there's no way to know. You know, I mean, some books.
It's the mysterious universe, New York.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So what you turned in, they said no.
Mm-hmm.
Was it far different from the Owl Moon Cafe?
It was. I had taken a trip to England and Ireland, and I had a really great idea for a book that would be set in America and then also go back, you know, to those countries.
Mm-hmm.
And did a lot of research for it, and someday I'll write that book, but it maybe now just isn't the time.
So it was more or less a synopsis proposal?
Yeah, I had a couple of chapters and a synopsis.
Okay.
That's usually the way I do it, is they want to see, oh, you know, two to three chapters and then an idea.
So then the Alan Moon Cafe came to you in a Vicodin haze,
mm-hmm.
and you wrote up a few chapters, and they said, yeah, we like this one.
Right.
So then what? I mean, how did the situation come to you? How did it develop that takes place in the book? You have, as you said, you have these four generations of women, and you have one woman who is at the close to the beginning, comes down with, you know, an illness that could be fatal. You deal with, you know, marijuana, treatment of medical marijuana. You have just, you know, a father coming back onto the scene. How did all of that happen?
Well, one observation that I've made in life is that it seems like if say, one woman in the family does something like have a baby out of wedlock, then, you know, their descendants seem to be, sometimes have that happen too, and it's puzzling to me. I think about things like that. You know, what would make someone drop out of school and then let her daughter drop out of school and on and on? So that was part of it. And I have an illness that is chronic. It's certainly not fatal. but I'm interested in illness and I'm interested in healing. And medical marijuana just seemed like way, way too fun of something to exclude from the book. And the more I looked into that, the more I learned about marijuana, which I don't smoke, Mom, honest. It being a medicine used years and years ago, 100 years ago. And so that was kind of fun. And I wanted to put the women in a sort of tight quarters. So I had Mariah, the 33-year-old loser job, and have to move home above the restaurant. And the other idea, the restaurant itself, well, whenever I go to visit my son, who lives in Monterey, I go to Carmel to this one bakery, and I just love it. You know, I think about it a lot. And I thought, well, that would be really fun. Not only will these four people be in tight quarters living above the restaurant, but then what if their work is the restaurant, too? So they're pretty much together 24 hours a day. So that was sort of how it came about.
And then what? What is your process? Talk about a little bit about how you write that. Do you scope out the book and pretty much know where you're going? Do you only know as far as the next chapter? Do you have an overall sense of how it's going to end or even a specific ending?
Well, I wish you were here so you could see my closet in my office. It's a pretty good-sized closet, and about 4 feet up from the bottom and 4 feet in, and probably 6 feet across. And that was filled with drafts of this book all the way to the top. This book took me forever to get right. Usually I'll start with character and image. I'll see an image of something that interests me fictionally, either something to write toward or to begin with. And so I start that way. And I do character analyses. I write down their ages and what their interests are, and it was particularly important for this book, especially where the character of Allegra was concerned, because she is a product of, you know, the 60s. And I had to make sure I got everything right. Fact-checking in this book was huge. And then, although I try to outline, I just can't seem to manage an outline or follow an outline. So I sort of write to find out where I'm going, which may explain some of the closet drafts.
Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Joanne Mapson, author of The Owl and Moon Cafe, published by Simon & Schuster. By the way, I love this cover.
And thank you. I love it, too.
When did you see it? At what point did you see it, and was it this at the beginning?
It was fairly late in the process that I saw the cover. They had upped my pub date, and all of a sudden, you know, I was like doing checking on the galleys, and I still hadn't seen the cover. And then they sent me three different covers, and they were all beautiful, all of them. And I was so happy with this cover because of the owl and because there's a detail in the sign where you can see it needs to be repainted, and that was part of the book, so it really fit. And then the houses that are along the bottom are very typical of Pacific Grove, California.
Yeah.
And at first, the owl didn't have wings. They had him just sitting there, and he looked really brooding. And I said, well, could we just, like, add wings?
Mm-hmm.
And now I love him. Now I think he's perfect.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
They have given me the best covers. I am so lucky.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you read to us?
Who do you want to hear from?
Who do I want to hear from? I think I want to hear from Allegra.
Okay, let me find an Allegra passage to read to you. I love Allegra. I think she is just the greatest. She's so happy with herself and doesn't really care what anybody thinks. She just goes along her way. Okay, this is probably two-thirds a ways into the book, and Allegra and her granddaughter, Lindsay, have gone to the Monterey Bay Aquarium. Yeah. A diver in the Outer Bay exhibit was taking photographs. Allegra sat in her wheelchair thinking of Sally's mother. It was a different world when you looked people in the waist instead of their faces. She imagined this was Lindsay's view, too, being so short, and tried to see the exhibit through the handprints on the glass. Giant bluefin tuna swam by, and silvery barracuda, those hobgoblins of the water world. The yellowfin tuna swam in a school, making tight turns in unison, shining, to borrow Gerard Manley Hopkins' turn of phrase, like shook foil. The wise old faces of the sea turtles reminded her of Al. The hammerhead sharks looked scary, but their mouths were only large enough for small fish, squid, and crustaceans. According to the sign, this 54-foot-long by 15-foot-tall tank was the largest window in the world and held 1 million gallons of seawater, kept fresh by a state-of-the-art filtering system. Sitting here was like being inside the ocean, still and peaceful, the room dim and quiet. Allegra wished she'd thought to come here months ago, because no pill in the world could take her mind off illness like watching Lindsay watching fish. Her granddaughter would have happily waited hours to see that lumpy old sunfish. They were the underdogs of the sea, and Lindsay was their lone cheerleader. "Look, Allegra," she said when one finally swam into view. "There goes my favorite fish in the world." "He's a lucky fellow," Allegra said. "We should bring Al here. He's so busy, I'll bet he's never been. You could give him a tour." "Dr. G's nice," Lindsay said. "We talk about science a lot. He helped me with the project, and he let me sit in his office chair. I'm glad. Oh, my, look at the time. We better get our butts in gear. Gammy will flip her lid, and your mother will give birth to a cow." "No way," Lindsay said, pushing the wheelchair toward the exit. "My mom's probably already out to dinner with Scotland Weird." "Why don't you like Fergus?" Allegra said. "I don't hate him," Lindsay answered. "I just miss how things used to be." "Me too," Allegra said, "but good stuff rarely happens without painful changes." "Look at me, Doc wanting to marry me. Who would have thought?" Lindsay smiled. "It's like you're a princess. It's just..." Allegra saw the waver in her granddaughter's jaw. "What, honey?" "Sometimes I wish the good part would hurry up and happen for me." "It will, sweetie, any minute now, I promise."
Thank you. That was Joanne Mapson reading from The Owl and Moon Cafe, published by Simon & Schuster. You have your four women, main characters, Lindsay, Mariah, Allegra, and Gammy. Where did each of them come from? Are they based on people? Are they composites? Have they been with you for a while and just had to see print?
Well, my good friend Erlene Fowler swears that each of the characters is me in one or another form, and she's probably right. Allegra, I'm very interested in people who can stay moored in the 60s and still survive in the year 2006. Grandmother Gammy, I used all of my mother's weird sayings in this book. I tried to just get every single one she had ever said and put it in Gammy's mouth. And I would say that Gammy, if she reminds me of anyone, it's my mom's mother, my grandmother, mm-hmm. who passed away. And Lindsay and Sally, I suppose Sally is probably the closest to me. Lindsay is probably the way I would act in public at her age, very quiet and watching things. But Sally, who's the wild girl, that's me.
Mm-hmm. And then structure, where you alternate between the point of view characters. How did that develop?
I drew this huge sort of horizontal map of the book and pasted the pages all over my office, which was basically a plot line for each character. I knew that I wanted love to come to all of the characters, but in different forms. And in order to keep track of that, I really had to have a visual that I went by. I knew that Mariah would get a boyfriend, that Allegra would find love at the strangest time of her life, and that Lindsay would find a friendship that would be one of those alliances that, you know, if taken care of, could last a lifetime. So that was one way that I did it.
Mm-hmm. Do you... I know you said you have just paper everywhere. Do you do anything on the walls, or do you have to see, have a visual of where you're going? You know, some sort of, I don't know, whether it's paper, butcher paper, or cards strung up all over the place? Do you have to see, or do you just keep it kind of all in your head?
I suppose before menopause, I could keep it all in my head. But now I take, you know, just regular pieces of 8.5 by 11 paper, and I glue them onto my, or tape them onto my closet, which is pretty large. And I also have a checklist of things that need to be resolved before the end of the book. And I have that as well on a list. And I really do need to see stuff outright. I wish you could see, well, I don't wish that you could see my office right now, but in addition to having my computer, I have brought in a table that is covered with stuff for the book I'm working on now. They're all in piles, but they're really organized piles. So if I need to find some little bit of information about the kind of birds that are in that part of California, I pull it out and look at it. And I can tell you a funny story about the Alan Moon Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
I decided I wanted the girls to do this marijuana science project. And, you know, with the Internet these days, it's so easy to do research. Just click here and download there. But it's not always accurate. So I decided I needed to get a book about growing marijuana, which they didn't have at the library. So I went to the Barnes & Noble, and I found the clerk, and I said, okay, I really need a book on cultivating marijuana, and I need it to be very simple because it would be from these 12-year-old girls' point of view. And he just looked at me like, you are not fooling me. There's no way you're using this for research. That was a little bit hard, but if you notice, I put an author's note in the back
of
the book.
I noticed that.
So my mom wouldn't be upset.
Did your editor or agent, did anyone have anything to say about that? Or was there any worry that maybe it would be too controversial?
No, they didn't mention anything, and I sure thought they would. Nope, they
well,
were
fine. Well, that's reassuring.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Reassuring.
Yeah.
Very reassuring. You know, before we take a break, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your voice, really, because you know, the past few books very much, if your name wasn't on this book or on your books, I would still know it was you. And that's one of those things that I think we talk about a lot as instructors with beginning writers, especially because everyone is always wondering, how do you get that? You know, how do you arrive at voice? And is it your voice for all of your writing, or is it your voice for this particular project? How do you deal with voice, and do you even think about it anymore?
Do we have a semester to cover all that? Oh, gosh, it's hard, and it never gets any easier. You know, in doing character sketches, writing out the character's experiences, like, for example, Allegra went to the Monterey Pop. So then I think, okay, I've got this particular year where she was this particular age, and you can find the slang, you know, from that era.
Mm-hmm.
And she loves poetry, so I knew with her voice I could be a little bit more introspective and imagistic. And she's very dramatic, so her voice gets exclamation points. Mariah, on the other hand, well, working as a college professor as I have for many years, witnessing academia, which is strange at best, I knew she would talk in bigger words and she would be holding in all of her frustrations and they would come out in strange ways. And so with her, I would look at long passages of introspection and then almost as if it's a product of that introspection, her dialogue would be where you would see the true Mariah. And with Lindsay, I was kind of going on what I remember from being that age. But I do like to hang out with kids and hear their voices when I'm trying to write a child or an adolescent.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well,
then it sort of becomes a way of like saying, okay, the sentence structure is too similar. You know, these characters are talking the exact same kind of sentence structure.
Mm-hmm.
And so I go in and mess it up and make a note, Lindsay, fragments, stuff like that.
And you mess it up during the first draft, or do you just wait until you get it all down and then go back over at the second draft?
I wrote 4 complete drafts of this book, and their voices changed significantly with each one of those rewrites. So So, you know, I don't get it right the first time. I always try. But I really think that that's a process that you can't shortcut. You know, you have to write it out, and then the character's voice grows as you continue to revise.
Mm. More to say on revision when we return. So please stay with us. We will be back. Joanne will be with us during the second half. So do not touch your dial. Do not touch your web browser. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Heaven sends.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
It's appalling. That's my reaction to a system that requires customers to buy groceries by running their finger over a scanner. Fingerprint shopping is being tested at grocery stores across the country. In a program system, your fingerprint is linked to your credit card or bank account. At best, fingerprint matching is only 80% accurate, and all technology can be compromised. Who takes the print to set up your account? A checker trained in biometrics? Hardly. Where are the laws that define the purchase, sale, or transfer of these unique parts of your body to others? And where's the time-saving factor? You still have to key in a code, sign a receipt, and say paper or plastic. I'm Mari Frank, co-host of Privacy Piracy. To learn more about this issue and other privacy issues, join us on Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett on Thursdays at 5 p.m. on KUCI FM in Irvine. Bye-bye.
Yee-haw! The opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the management of KUCI or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about this show, go to KUCI.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are also broadcasting on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We're also podcasting. I have to remember to tell you all about the podcasts that are up. You can go to my website, which is penonfire.com. Click on the radio tower. You'll arrive at the radio page, and you'll see more links to the podcasts. There must be about 48 shows up at this point. From the present back to when I started this show in, let's see, my son was 3, he's 11 now, so, you know, you do the math, it's been a while. This show with Joanne will be up next week, hopefully, And so we have current shows as well as not so current up on the podcast. Let's bring Joanne back. I'm with Joanne Mapson, author of The Owl and Moon Cafe, published by Simon & Schuster. And Joanne, I must say, this fudge is so tasty.
It is good, isn't it?
Really good. This one is a maple walnut. And wow, it's really wonderful.
I tried all the flavors to make sure.
And Joanne is going to be in Huntington Beach. She's coming down from Alaska and will be in Huntington Beach on Saturday, July 15th. That's next week. Barnes & Noble, Huntington Beach at 1 p.m. And if you come down, if you go to her signing, you can buy a book and get a piece of fudge, which I think that's a pretty great deal, personally.
Nothing better than sitting down with a good book and fudge is what I think.
Well, anyway, before the break, we were talking about, actually, you were talking about how you wrote four complete drafts of The Owl and Moon Cafe. Will you talk about that? What do you mean when you say four complete drafts?
It means that the whole draft had to go into the closet and a new draft had to begin.
So you didn't take what you had and tweak it, you just started over?
Mostly I kept the stuff in my head. There may have been passages here and there that I thought, I'm going to use that, but probably in a different way. But it was basically like starting over. And the first draft, my editor really did not like, and I was stunned. I thought it was really funny. That's usually a bad sign for me if I think it's funny. And I guess I have to thank her. After all, I learned on this book that it is like learning to write every single time. You know, it's just, there's no shortcutting that. You just have to humble yourself and go, okay, good job, put that aside, do better.
You know, that is so interesting because when writers say that they have written, you know, multiple drafts of a book, I think for the most part what they're talking about is taking what their first draft was and going through it and changing a little here, changing a little there, not sort of putting it away.
That's not what I'm talking about at all. I'm talking about the whole enchilada goes in the closet. And then you start over with a brand new beginning.
That is impressive.
Humbling.
I think the only other person I've ever heard that actually does that is Jeff Parker.
I was just thinking of him when you said that.
And, you know, to me, that is just, it's such a sign of professionalism to go, okay, I got to do another draft and to just start over.
Well, I think what's interesting about it is, you know, less than being humble. It's more about learning your own technique, your own process. You don't really know what it is. But if you allow yourself to be flexible and fluid and put aside a draft, let it go, better stuff comes. And, you know, that's a lesson I think I've really learned with this book, is to trust that there's better stuff. There's better stuff there that will come out if you set that aside.
Does this book resemble anything? I mean, does it resemble any one of those drafts in any way, or is it?
Same characters, mm-hmm. way different men. With this book, I tried very hard to put in men who were good guys. I always get reviews saying, oh, the men, you know, they're no good in her books. But I thought, well, okay, what would happen if instead of having typical, you know, back and forth, boy gets girl kind of tension, what if I just put them together at the beginning? Then what will happen? And I think that came about in the third draft.
I've never thought that about your books, that the men are no good. That's interesting. Now I'm thinking back, and it's like, well, why?
Oh, you know, critics, they have to say something.
They have to say something. Yeah, but it's interesting. I mean, your men, I'm thinking of Hank and Chloe, Blue Rodeo. I mean, they all have some depth going. They have, you know, they're not just stereotypes.
They're guys I would date if I wasn't married 32 years.
Interesting. So, okay, so you got the go-ahead from your agent, editor, I guess, at that point, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Or did it go through your agent?
Oh, I have them both read it at the same time.
Okay. So you got the go-ahead to do the book. Is the next time your editor at Simon & Schuster, next time that she sees your book, when you have a draft, or are you sending, you know, pieces along the way and she's saying, yeah, keep going with this or do a little bit more with this?
I give them full drafts. I can't write that way, that looking at chapter by chapter, I lose sight of the whole. I know some people do that. I know Jodi Picoult does that with her editor,
mm-hmm.
or her agent, I think. And it works great for her, but I can't do that. I get stymied real quick. You know, I think we can't remind writers and people who want to write enough that you need to keep your cards close to your chest when you're in the embryonic stages.
Mm-hmm.
Talking too much about a project or showing multiple, you know, drafts to people can really get you confused.
And what about as well when you're doing your draft, you might even be on your second draft, and the marketplace intrudes so often, especially if you read magazines like Publishers Weekly or you subscribe to Publishers Lunch and you are constantly reading about deals and what's working in publishing and what isn't working and how difficult it is to sell fiction. What do you do with all that? Or do you, at this point, do you just keep it at bay and just figure you do what you do, and if they like it, they like it, and if they don't, they don't?
Well, to be honest with you, that is a burden. And in this past year, I've stopped reading every single review in Publishers Weekly because it can get you really depressed and make you run out of gas on your own writing. Same with New York Times Book Review. I subscribe to both of those and have since before I was published. You know, it gets to a point where you think, okay, I have this amount of time that I can work on things, and if I spend that time reading this other information, it gets in my head and it blocks out the space that I need to write. So I've tried to let that go a lot this year. On the other hand, it is really good to have a knowledge of what's going on in the publishing world. But like, for example, the book I'm working on now, I make a reference to Huntington's chorea, the disease that Woody Guthrie died from.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm reading Saturday by Ian McEwan,
mm-hmm.
teaching it in the fall, and it's right in that book.
Yeah.
Like, oh, man. You know, so, oh, scrap that Huntington's disease thing. We'll find something else.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think that's good that you brought that up. I'm sure other writers feel the same way.
Well, I know of writers who just really worry about just such things as, well, let's see, my main character is in her 70s. Can I write that? Will they buy it? Should I make her younger? I mean, things that you're not necessarily just staying with yourself and deciding for yourself, but you're thinking, what's marketable? What's New York going to want or not want?
That reminds me of a conversation I had with my agent. In between all of the drafts, I had sent her an idea for my next book, and the main character was 68. And she said, nope, let's make her 38.
Hmm.
And I thought, okay, well, you know, it's not that big of a difference.
Right.
Actually, the same kind of growth, the arc of growth in the book is the same. And who knows? You know, maybe that was the right move. I just know that I can return to books that have narrators like that. Stones for Ibarra is
mm-hmm.
one.
And
yes. I just love that kind of writing. But maybe that isn't what's selling right now. And so then it becomes sort of a deal you make with yourself. You know, am I willing to change my idea to suit marketability? Well, usually the answer is yes. But there are places where I've held out and made them happy in the long run.
Mm-hmm. Ah, well, you are listening to Writers on Writing, and I am with Joanne Mapson, author of The Owl and Moon Cafe. Will you read to us again?
Sure. How about I read something from Lindsay's point of view?
Sounds great.
I love Lindsay. Okay, Lindsay goes to a school for gifted girls called Country Day Academy, and so they don't have things like math and reading. They have classes like life path, life questions. And so she's sitting at her desk, and the teacher calls on her. Lindsay Moon, I asked you a question, Mrs. Shiasaka said. Are you wool gathering? Lindsay startled and dropped her pencil. No, ma'am, I'm listening. Could you please repeat the question? Certainly. Can you think of an example of human kindness that goes above and beyond normal everyday manners? My grandmother's doctor made a house call. A house call? That is unusual in this day and age, isn't it, girls? Why did he do that? Because she has cancer? Behind her, she heard Taylor Foster snort and Cheyenne Goldenblatt snicker. How is cancer funny? Without turning her head to look, she could sense Sally, two chairs down from her, getting mad or madder, since this morning they'd made fun of Sally's Vera Bradley backpack, even though it was hot pink and lime green, and those were the popular colors. Belva, Mrs. Shiasaka said, zeroing in on the only girl who was quieter than Lindsay. We haven't heard a peep from you all morning. Surely you have a valuable contribution to group discussion. Belva Satterley was president of the Grammar Club and allergic to wheat. She was one of those girls who got B's but was okay with it. Lindsay tuned her out and tried to imagine various responses to the awful comments that would come her own way at lunchtime. Cancer! It's catching! It'll eat you up in no time! This year, all her classes were like art. Paintings, essays, science fair, hairstyle, backpack, it all had to be perfect, even if your mom was a waitress, even though she hated it. And since you were the one who balanced her checkbook, you knew how little money there was to live on. In her backpack, Lindsay carried a jumbo-sized bottle of Pepsi, bought with the $15 Gammy had slipped her so she could take Sally to the movies to make up for Lindsay practically living at D. Thomas Farms. Tums didn't work anymore. The Pepsi directions read, do not take for more than 14 days in a row without consulting a physician. So every 13th day, Lindsay skipped one. Girls, attention please, Mrs. Shiasaka said over the chatter. If you could choose any person living or dead to have dinner with, whom would you select and why? You have 10 minutes to create your brainstorming cluster. That way, we'll have time to share before nutrition break. You may begin as soon as I put on our creativity enhancement. That meant playing a CD during class. Music supposedly assisted the linear thinking part of the brain to release creative answers. Lindsay Moon knew Country Days CDs by heart. The adagio that made Avril cry, the album that had Paco Bell's Canon played every which way there was, and R. Carlos Nakai's CD flute music. Why couldn't they play Vivaldi's Four Seasons so she could hear Winter? Allegra had it. Maybe she could burn a copy, but wait, wasn't that stealing? If everyone in the world took one thing like that, the economy would suffer and eventually collapse, and then where would humanity be? She tapped her pencil against her fingers. When she'd signed up for this course, an interdisciplinary approach to human ethics and alternative evolutions in decision-making, it sounded useful. Who wouldn't want a chance to learn something that might help a geek like her prepare for whatever fresh hell came her way in high school? But so far, Life Paths, Life Questions was pretty much like every other class at Country Day. Another circle of learning, as Country Day did not believe in desks and rows.
Thank you. That was Joanne Mapson reading from the Owl and Moon Cafe. I am so curious about setting. Your settings are almost like characters, really. I mean, I'm thinking of just other books of yours where, I mean, all of your books, really. Setting is so distinct, and I'm wondering if you choose setting according to where you would like to be or where you are or what is just you know, alive and brimming over in you. How are you dealing with setting?
Well, the last four books that I've written have mostly taken place in Monterey, California, because my son lives there, and it's my only way of getting to visit him is to write the book there. But I love that place. I love it. It's one of the most beautiful parts of California, and there's no way on earth that I could ever afford to live there. So sometimes I choose a setting because it's a place I like to go. In the past, I've chosen settings that are an amalgamation of different places. Like, for example, in the Wilder Sisters, the town of Floralee is a combo of several towns, Taos, Santa Fe, Truchas, lots of different places. But for me, setting, landscape, it is like a living, breathing character, and I'd like to see what I can wring out of it. Mm-hmm. For example, in Monterey, they have this butterfly migration every year, and the town just goes nuts over butterflies, and people come in to see the monarchs and whatnot. And then they have all this history behind there, and it's fun to look into that as well. You know, those sepia-toned photographs mm-hmm. you sometimes see in restaurants?
Mm-hmm.
This is the town in 1810. Those just captivate me.
Uh-huh.
And I have tons and tons of books on place for every book I've ever written.
Interesting. What about Alaska? I know Alaska was in your last book.
Well, yikes. Alaska is really, really hard to write about. It's really hard to write about because it's huge. I mean, it's just this immense thing. And the wonders here, the glaciers and the rivers and the mountains, they're just so enormous that you look at them and think, okay, what are the descriptions? Majestic, threatening. It's almost as if I can't assimilate that yet. I know I will write about Alaska, but I don't feel I've really got enough under my belt yet to render it so that it comes alive the way my other book settings have done.
Interesting. Well, and talk about endings a bit. The ending of this book, I liked how it ended on an upbeat, but there were a lot of ends that weren't necessarily tied up.
Well, I wanted to leave it that way on purpose. I love endings that make you wonder, what happened the next day?
Yeah.
Or what happened that night? Or who did the dishes? Those are just, I love books like that. And at the end of this book, there's a near miss of a tragedy, very near miss.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted that in there as well because I thought that it provided a future. You know, this didn't happen. It could have happened, and we all know how that ending would have been, but it didn't.
Yes.
And it's unusual. And so where do they go from here? Well, they're walking out the door, and they don't know where they're going, but there's the implication that there's a future. And so the reader can wonder about it.
And also, I suppose, it leaves it open. It just occurred to me, it does leave it open that if you wanted to do a sequel,
mm-hmm.
you can do that. I mean, we're all waiting. We're all wondering.
Uh-huh.
It's just like if there's a sequel, we'll grab it.
In the old days, I would have said, oh, I'll never write a series. Just how horrible. But it's really fun to go back to a character at a different age. Like, for example, Phoebe in Bad Girl Creek makes an appearance in this book. And you get enough little details about her life where you can sort of fill in the blanks and go, wow, that's a whole nother story.
Yes.
You know, I'd be good with reading that book.
Mm-hmm.
And in the book I'm working on now, the characters in this book make an appearance.
Interesting. And when are we going to see it?
Well, gosh, I only have 50 pages written. I'm writing as fast as I can.
Okay, no pressure.
Well, I'm teaching full-time, and that does definitely take up time, but I think I'm going to ask for a course release in the spring to see if I can get this draft done.
How does teaching affect your writing?
Well,
I mean, aside from the you know, it takes up your time, but how does it affect?
First of all, I really like teaching, and I think it offers me a balance in my life. Without it, I can waste time. With teaching, I know how to schedule my time. The great part about it is I have the dream job. I'm teaching in an MFA program with really talented writers, and they keep me young, and they teach me more than I teach them, I think. And I've had to work hard to sort of guard those days off and make them mine and my writing days, because if you let teaching and students enter your life too deeply, they can suck away all your creativity. So I think I have the best of both worlds.
We have a few minutes left with Joanne Mapson, author of The Owl and Moon Cafe, published by Simon & Schuster. What about reading? How does what you're reading affect what you're writing? Or does it?
I just don't think there's enough hours in the day to read. I love to read. And my students hate me because I'll assign 7 books for a semester class. And they get mad and say, there's no time to read these. And I say, yeah. There's nothing better to do with your time. Right. Turn off the TV.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of my favorite writers, I love Alice Hoffman, Ellen Gilchrist, Jim Harrison, James Lee Burke. And I read them, and I'm in the story, and I'm lost. Other stories I don't get into as deeply, and I can start analyzing and figure out, you know, I could try something like that in my book. And I think the only people I have to really be careful of reading so their writing doesn't bleed into my own is Jim Harrison and Alice Hoffman.
Hmm.
I tend to just be so bowled over by their phrasing that I'll start to write in that style in my book and then go, oh, that has to go.
Mm.
That's Jim, not me.
Yes, yes.
And we have a new dog here.
You do?
Yes. We have Piper, the Italian Greyhound, who came from Washington to join Henry, the other Italian Greyhound. And Piper is very happy to be here and very happy to bark at whatever moose walks by.
Now, which dog is in the photo with you in the book? It's a wonderful photo, by the way.
Thank you. That's Henry,
my first
Italian Greyhound.
Mm-hmm.
And he is the camera ham. You take out a camera and he'll jump up on your lap immediately. He eats the camera.
He has such good posture, too.
I know, and he's so much prettier than me. But you know why I always have a dog in my picture if I can?
Why?
I hate having my picture taken. And I can relax when I'm around a dog.
Well, this is a great picture of you. I love this picture, and it's great of Henry, too.
And there were about 80 really bad pictures taken before that.
Oh, there always are.
Yes, Stuart always says, I am not taking your picture next time, but then he always relents. Well, Barbara, I wish you were here.
Well, gosh, one of these days I'm going to get up there.
We got plenty of room.
I love Alaska in books. I love Alaska in movies. Limbo was such a weird movie, and I think part of why I loved it was it was in Alaska.
It's
just like, Alaska?
It's definitely a landscape where you feel small and insignificant.
Mm-hmm.
When a black bear walks down your driveway, you think, oh, we're really not the only ones here. And like last week, Stuart and I took a hike in a park in the middle of Anchorage, and we got lost.
Mm.
And that sounds funny, like, oh, how can you get lost in your city? But you really can.
Interesting.
Yeah, you need a compass to live here. You need water and blankets in your car at all times because you just never know.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's been wonderful to talk to you, and I just wish you the best of luck with this book.
Thank you.
Predict great things. And, everyone get up there to see her on the 15th, Huntington Beach, Barnes & Noble, 1 o'clock Saturday. And book, fudge, what could be better? Thanks, Joanne.
As always, wonderful to be on your show. Thank you for your hard work.
Oh, quite welcome.
Bye.
That was Joanne Mapson, author of The Owl and Moon Cafe, published by Simon & Schuster. I went through this book quickly. I was often seen lying down on the couch reading. At times when I should have been working, but you know what? When you're a writer, just about any time is a time you should be reading too, as long as you get your work done. So anyway, hope you can make it. Her website is joannemapson.com, all one word, and lots of great stuff on there. I'm going to leave you now and tell you my website is penonfire.com. You can email me from there if you want to be on the weekly email list. And I'm going to leave you with a quote by Brenda Ulland, who said, "So you see, imagination needs moodling, long, inefficient, happy idling, dawdling, and puttering." And Brenda Ulland wrote the wonderful book on writing called If You Want to Write. A wonderful book. So I thank you again for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Pen on Fire is my book. And I'll see you soon.